Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon. Thank you for coming today. My name is Jitendra Joshi. I'm the first vice president and co-convener of the club's Press Freedom Committee. Just to start with a couple of housekeeping notes, on Thursday next week, we'll be hosting a distinguished panel of speakers to address the burning topic of attacks on press freedom in Hong Kong. We hope to see many of you there. And for now, please, a gentle reminder to turn off your mobile phones or switch to silent now. So to today's topic, to some, the likes of Edward Snowden and Julian Assange are brave whistleblowers who have shone a light on into areas that governments would much prefer remain hidden. To others, they are nothing better than cyber anarchists who risk upending the rule of law and security for all. Our guest today, Bill Micah, I think leans towards the second view. That may put him at odds with some of us here today, but during his long career with the Canadian police, Bill dealt with far scarier audiences than we can offer. At one point during his undercover work, he lived with a bounty over his head offered by Colombia's much-feared Medellin cartel. The worst he has to fear from us today is a lively debate. On which note, please join me in welcoming Bill.
Thank you, Jitendra, and thank you, FCC, for giving me the opportunity to speak here today. It's probably my first time speaking publicly about some of these issues, and one of the reasons I came forward is because, like everybody else, I'm seeing in the news what seems to be a fairly slanted bias against government and security agencies for the efforts that they take, often which is never reported on, some of the methods that are used and some of the damage that's been caused to covert operations in particular haven't really been explained. So the first thing I want to say is, Wing offered me to speak here, and he gave me a choice of dates. He wanted me initially to speak yesterday on April Fool's Day, and I gratefully declined. But one thing I want to say for the record, whistleblower protection is 100% needed. I can say with absolute certainty that organizations that work in secrecy, organizations that work with the name of Privacy Act, Official Secrets Act, etc., they can cover up a lot of sins. Usually those sins are directed against their own employees, but when mistakes happen, they can be buried. And there's nobody in this room who can tell me anything different about that. So I am a very strong supporter of whistleblowers and whistleblower protection. I think part of the issue that's happened, from what I see in the debate, is in security services or covert operations, you have operational people and you have careerists. And the careerists are the bureaucrats who play it safe and climb the ladder. And from what I've seen, a lot of the people speaking on this debate are the careerists, not the operational people, mostly because they want to keep doing operational work. And also they don't want to disclose methods or activities which, in response to some of the allegations out there, would compromise other ongoing activities. One of the questions I'd just like to throw out to you is, like all of you, when President Obama, before he became president, he made all sorts of comment about how he's going to change security laws, how he's going to change the conduct by which the United States operates around the world. What has happened in the last 6 years that he's become president that has slowed that down? What did he learn? Now that he's president, he's tasked with knowledge. It's easy to have a view when you're not tasked with knowledge. What are the threats that he's seeing that not only allowed him to continue with a lot of the security measures that have been taken, but in some cases enhance them? In this debate regarding WikiLeaks et al., there's a lot of criticism about the Five Eyes, and the Five Eyes, of course, being the five main English-speaking countries of the UK, United States, Canada, New Zealand, and Australia. So they have a shared background. The one commonality of all these five countries, besides language and open government and freedom of the press and democracy, is that we have many walls built up around these countries to protect the, half the world wanting to climb through the doors and get into these countries. I noticed that where Mr. Assange and Edward Snowden have gone for comfort has been to countries that don't have those same open policies. So I think it's fair to question why that's the case. Before I can give you a full erecting. I think I'd like to spend a few minutes going into a bit of my background, just on a very superficial level, because it'll help provide some context and color to the views and the opinions that I hold. I don't ask anybody to agree with these views and opinions, but I've walked the walk, and I've been on both sides of the fence, both as the covert operator and as the fellow who was tasked with creating covert infrastructure to sustain all manner of undercover operations around the world. And undercover operations aren't just about somebody like me going in and infiltrating a group. Covert operations also support source witness relocation, pays for informants, moves people around the world. There's a much more to this agenda than just some agent going out and getting information. I grew up in a very typical Canadian middle-class family, graduated university in Halifax, and went over to Europe, and my first job was a Eurobond trader in the City of London. Within a year, I was so good at it, I came back to Canada and joined the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And in fairness, I actually, as a young boy, always wanted to be a Mountie. It's an iconic Canadian figure, and I wanted some adventure and excitement in my life. I wasn't motivated by the money. So after a few years of doing my general policing background, I went into our undercover program, which was quite a selection criteria. People may not be aware of this, but the Mounties have been running undercover operations as an organized force well over 100 years. By way of comparison, the FBI only started doing undercover operations in 1971 as a response to the Weathermen. So Canada has a very deep, rich history in running covert operations. I got into my first project was simply buying heroin and coke. Let's see if you can do street level stuff, see how you do. From that, I was actually pretty good at it. And then from there, they said, hey, Bill, we don't have guys like your background who come from capital markets. What do you know about futures and options? I said, I don't know anything about it. Okay, how would you like to go work for the FBI in Chicago, down the Chicago Board of Trade? So because of the being active in the markets, I had to deal with third party liability to the government. So studied economics courses, took my courses for the CFTC, as well as on the Canadian security side to trade futures and options. I then spent the next several years pretty much doing every criminal act you can do in a public market. And if I didn't do it, I was told about it or I observed it. That operation came to a conclusion, not because I didn't get enough targets. They targeted about 10% of the people on the trading floor. I ended up doing criminal acts with about 75-80%. If you charge one, you have to charge them all. As a result, it would have led to probably the ending of an independent pricing mechanism for many of Canadian grains and commodities. But that was a pivotal point, and I'll come back to it, because my covert identity was built from that basis. By not getting that project burned off, I was able to keep an identity, which was Bill McDonald, which had my high school records changed, university records changed. I had federally incorporated companies. I was paying personal taxes, had my social security number. So I was the real deal from a fairly young age. And luckily, I was able to keep that identity intact pretty much through my entire career. And that's important, because what's happened with the WikiLeaks and the Snowden disclosures is that they've ripped that type of process wide open. So at the end of that project, I was asked, hey, Bill, how would you like to work for the Americans again? And this was just a year after Pablo Escobar blew up the airliner, and it was pretty much all out war with the Medellin cartel. I said, okay, sure, what's the project? And they said, okay, we've identified one of the main, what they call a Cambianista, money launderer operating outside of Colombia for the Medellin cartel. This fellow was Colombian. They were laundering a lot of their money through commodity transactions. So grains, auto parts, didn't matter. They were shipping it into the free trade zones in Buenaventura and Cartagena. So long story short, the American agency was able to determine the movements for this fellow, and I was on the airplane seat beside him on a long flight. By the time the flight was over, we'd agreed to get together for dinner and drinks. And then over the next 3 years, I developed a relationship to the point where I was effectively asked to be the business agent for the Medellin cartel for their legitimate investments in North America. As an aside, all the things you're seeing today in Mexico, this was back in the early 90s. We were doing flat out all those activities. HSBC recently went down for the $2 billion fine on the money laundering. All those trade-based money laundering from Mexico, we were doing it identical 15 years earlier. And even then, they were always asking me, just as, again, as a little interesting aside, asking me, hey, Bill, can you get trucking warehousing businesses on the Canada-US border? And I said, well, why would you want that? Well, they were so sophisticated, they knew all about the North America Free Trade Agreement. They could see that over the next 7 years, there was going to be a lowering of the tariffs. And so they were setting up in Mexico even then to take drugs north, ostensibly to Canada. But what they were doing was breaking the bonded seals, dropping the drugs in the U.S., and then cash and weapons going back south. So that project came to an end because government was trying to protect the people. I get a 50-pound bag of sesame seeds sent to my covert office. I phoned down to Bogota. What do you want me to do with this? Bill, we'd like you to go to Burger King and McDonald's and offer them 20% under the latest invoice price for supplying them. At that point, the Department of Justice said, hold on a sec. You're not going to take the world's most violent cartel into McDonald's and Burger King. We'll get our asses sued off. And the other problem is, they said there's only one way you could do it. You have to go to the board of directors of McDonald's and Burger King, disclose who Bill is, and see if they'll agree with it. The problem with that, there was an automatic, a standing $100,000 hit on the life of any undercover who goes into these operations. That was how the cartel fought back. So that wasn't really a viable alternative, from my opinion. So following that, I went back to Canada, did other various undercover operations. We're familiar with the horrible events of 9/11. But before 9/11, the single largest act of aviation terrorism in the world wasn't Pan Am or Lockerbie. It was the Air India bombing over the 747 over the Indian Ocean. So on that day, 340 people were killed, of which 270 were Canadians. And again, not a widely known story outside of Canada, I suppose. But the main money man for that was later arrested, or the alleged main money man behind that was arrested, and I became his cellmate. I was ostensibly a stockbroker, arrested for fraud, and I became his cellmate. And the purpose of that wasn't to elicit a confession. It was simply for interrogation teams to get some insight into this person and for me to have dialogue. This person was really motivated by money. Again, talking about the different motivations that lead people to do terrorist acts. Following that, I was asked again to go work for the FBI. So I went down 3 years to out of Miami. And that investigation, Bermuda Short it was called, was considered by some media as the largest securities money laundering sting at that point in time in North America. We ended up arresting 60 people, took down two Russian mob-owned banks. I was asked to launder discounted bonds for Libya, North Korea, and Iran by a South African banker. I went through correspondent banking relationships, laundered money through Barclays Bank, Royal Bank of Canada. This is all in the public record, by the way, so I'm not. And at one point, I was told, hey, Bill, these Russians are going to murder this guy. Next day, about 40 machine gun rounds went through the guy's house. All of a sudden, that jeopardizes the project, because now we know that this is valid. So I tell cover team becomes the informant, notifies the third-party police force. We know who the shooters are. Here's what it's about. But again, this is the era of all this disclosure. It creates a lot of problems. That project, at the time, I was running about three multiple undercover operations all over the world and keeping the same identity intact, but having to balance it. One of the things that blew that up, I was at the point where I had the one lawyer who offered to sell me PayPal. And that's interesting on WikiLeaks that they take all their money from PayPal. About 3-4 months before they were purchased by eBay, my cartel organization that I was representing was generating about $3 million a day in street drug sales, ostensibly about $1 billion a year was my story. This lawyer, who has since gone to jail, said, look, Bill, I know the guys who are looking to sell PayPal. Why don't we use your drug money to buy PayPal? You got the benefit of being able to launder more cash each month. Plus, you get all the knowledge of who has the account holders so you can use it for other criminal activity. And again, WikiLeaks anonymously takes all their money through, or did at the time, through PayPal. So there's no way he knows who his client is. It could have been the Russian intelligence service, the Iranians, or the Chinese. Take your pick. So after that project, well, the reason that project ended for me was because a junior FBI agent, when we started the project, said, look, you need to give me a clean covert account because I'm having money wired back through to me. So he says, no problem. So they give me an account name. It was called Northern Star Shipping. And I said, okay, it was a bank account in Wachovia in Miami. I'll route the money, have it come through. What the fella didn't understand when I said, give me a nice clean account name, he just changed the account number, but gave me the same covert company name that had been used in about 30 other operations that was about to go public. So it was all going to be in the media. And that's the problem with smart bad guys, is they know how to data mine as much as the government knows how to data mine. So the risk that it would compromise that investigation, which we'd already been 3 years into, and I had Italian mafia believing I had 2 tons of cocaine at that time sitting in a warehouse in Jamaica. and we were about to do a full sweep, but we couldn't take the risk of continuing it. Then 9/11 happened. It was all at the same time. 9/11 happened, and so I got called back to Ottawa and said, look, Bill, we need to change our game plan, and we need to ramp up our covert ability to go after global organized crime and terrorism. So I did the audit of our national, what we call backstopping, our national backstopping, because the digital age has exponentially increased the risk to running covert operations because we cannot protect the identities and the legends of our people. And so I went from being the front end operator to now having to come up with methods that we could protect our people out in the field and protect witnesses, protect informants and the like. So I worked in conjunction with a partner of mine, Brad Damaris, and so we came up with an approach that we actually looked at global money launderers and saw how they did things, and we said, okay, we're going to set up an original set of identity, and then we're going to create multiple layers on that identity through multiple jurisdictions so we could deflect surveillance or counter-surveillance onto the identities through multiple jurisdictions. It's probably worthwhile for me quickly to explain to you the difference between legends or cover story and backstopping, because it's central to the damage that's been done. A legend is simply, I can't show up somewhere at 30, 40 years of age and have no history behind me. Where did I go to school? Was I an engineer? Was I a teacher? So you need to come up with a credible story about why you're there, why you're a person of interest to the group you're going after. Once you've established your legend or cover story, the critical component then becomes you need to backstop that. You know, Bill, you say you went to Harvard. Okay, well, I can't find you on the records of Harvard. You say that you work for IBM. Well, I just phoned their HR department and you never worked for IBM. You know, Bill, I did a credit check and I can see that you've had a credit card for 4 years, but what about the 12 years before that? These things don't make sense. And organized crime, terrorist groups, they've all got it figured out. All these disclosures just keep telling them how we do things. So it's important on that whole backstopping. So when we started looking at it, you know, back in 10, 15 years ago, it was easy. And I go back when I told you when I had my backstopping after doing that commodity deal. So I had all my records. They were able to be changed. When we started the process 10 years ago or 15 years ago, we would go to a university and then say, look, we need to create an identity. Can we have Joe Smith be a graduate in 1988 or 1992? And they said, yeah, we can do that. But then guess what happens? The sequential numbering of student numbers doesn't allow us to place you in there. Okay, that's being complicated. Then things like, okay, guys, when guys would go on the course, we give them their support ID and say, okay, go open a bank account. So the days where we go to the bank, you would open up a bank account, but then they say, okay, you can't use a post office box anymore as an address. You know, it's a part of your KYC and AML issues. So give us your home address. Well, what we used to do is, we're not going to give our home address, of course, or some innocent third party's home. So we would drive by, we'd see a construction site where there used to be a home that's now going to be an apartment building or a townhouse. We would use that address. We'd give it to the bank, because they'd be able to check on their database that that's a home address. But then we would go to the post office, put a change of address in there. So any mail, anything coming to us would come actually to the post office box. Well, what happened with the technology age? I can sit there and do Google Map and I can look down and say, well, that's no house, that's a bloody apartment complex. What's going on here? So these are the kind of issues that start challenging law enforcement on a daily basis of how we support our people. And some of these projects take 1 to 2 years to set up. And so when we went about it, we were dealing mostly in English common law countries, but when we had to go to civil law countries to set up storefronts or to set up business apparatus, it's a different legal system. And so in some cases, we had to deal with political people to see if we could get parliamentary committees to give us approval that we could do these operations. And mostly they didn't want us doing things targeting their citizens without them being aware of what was going on. But the bottom line of it all is that all of that required us to work with our embassies, deal with diplomatic staff, because we had to say to them, in all cases, they didn't know that it was us to set up a covert operation that was asking somebody who worked for trade and industry or somebody in business development. Some of these countries, we needed to know what was the business practice. Who are lawyers that we could work with who wouldn't ask too many questions? You know, could we set up this type of apparatus. So a lot of them were fairly benign business questions. But again, somebody who was to get given carte blanche, 2 million cables, they could start connecting names and dots and it would make some sense to them. You know, when I did that last operation out of Miami, I had to meet the South African banker. He would never fly to the United States for obvious reasons. So we would meet in third countries. And as we met in those countries, you know, they were pretty lax on law enforcement. Typically, you would tell the host country where you're doing something if you had good relations with them, because they could help provide surveillance, also give you the lay of the land. But in many cases, you can't trust these local police or governments. So guess what? The American ambassador had to give permission for me to travel to these countries, you know, the ambassador in those specific countries, so I could record or meet my targets and do the recordings. And so I had to give him, well, I didn't, the FBI, they had to provide my real name, my covert name, and the covert businesses that I was operating under in case it blew up. He would know how to respond in that local business or political environment. So again, a whole bunch of information is going out. Guys like Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, they know the square root of Dick All about how covert operations are run. Julian Assange says he's a journalist. I've never seen him do any fact-checking. All I see him is take a bunch of stolen information and throw it out into the public domain without any consequence, regard for the consequences. I've yet to see anybody on WikiLeaks editorial board that has any type of covert background to know what type of information is going out there and what it means and what the impact of it is. So, you know, I know people say Assange is some hero, but I don't quite get it. You know, one of the things too that strikes me as odd, everybody's ganging up on the government about how they do things. For sure, people do some bad things, but typically you don't hear about the 10,000 things that are done right. And when you do these operations, you know, it's not one guy going out and doing it. You've got cover teams, you've got surveillance teams, you're doing financial reporting, you've got to maintain safe houses, you've got to be following up with analysts, you've got to do liaison with host agencies. All this creates a bucket load of information and documents that have to go somewhere. And most of these get databased on secure systems. And again, you know, I look at Assange and I look at Snowden, and I see guys that basically seem to have a chip on the shoulder. They're fairly proficient in their IT, and they're very bold in what their belief is on how government should be run, but have no context to know how government actually does a lot of the operations that save lives daily. I'll give you a case in point. One of the trainings that they gave me, about a handful of us who were doing a lot of high risk undercover, they took us to a military base. And on this base is where Canada's equivalent of the SAS or your Delta Force for the Americans, where they did their training. And so they took us into, we did a lot of, they take what they call the killing rooms, which are big oak rooms, and it's set up as a desk or office. And that was for the operators to learn how do you get your gun out if you're under a desk or in a briefcase. And you realize very quickly, if bad guys confront you, because things turn bad very quickly, you can never react in time. And the lesson learned is, you know, and it was said to me several times, Bill, we can't give you close cover. You're going to be on your own in there. So if any problems happen, run through the window or jump for the door. And that's the best that we can offer our people. So you really think that I need to have somebody like Snowden and Assange dumping out even more information that compromises that? And, you know, on that whole training, to tell you how real it is, we can talk niceties about theory and liberty and all those things. But let's put where the you know, metal meets the road, or rubber meets the road, sorry. Within that course, they took about 10 of us. They took us into a classroom, and they had the lights out. And during that time, so the lights are out, we're sitting in a classroom, then they start playing an audio recording. And that audio recording is of an undercover being murdered. And then for the next 2 hours, that's all we listen to, is a whole bunch of undercover people being murdered. And that's why it becomes so important that you know your cover story, that your cover story is intact. And that was what the whole lesson and purpose of that training was: know your cover story, stay in your cover story, and to realize how quickly to pick up on the cues, both verbal and nonverbal, so you can get out of trouble very quickly. So when I hear again that Assange, WikiLeaks are doing all these wonderful things, there's thousands of men and women out there who are putting their life on the line. And they're the ones who are getting shafted by these stupid disclosures. I look at, let's just deal with Snowden for a sec. So he says, I'm offended by the Constitution, the breaches of the Constitution. I am too, if I'm a victim of abuse. But what does he do? He goes in and he takes 1.5 million files that pertained to other things beyond meta mining for data. And so on that 1.5 million files, how's that any different than these illegal fishing fleets that go out there with 100 kilometers of net and take everything in the ocean? They only need 3 species of fish, but they wipe out everything and create virtual deserts behind them. I don't see the difference between how Snowden has gone in and destroyed so many other operations and apparatus and things that protect the citizens, not just of the United States, but of the world. So, people want to call him a hero, fly at it, but he's no hero of mine. And the biggest danger I see today is not with big bad government. And again, I've seen abuses, so I'm not defending them blindly. And people got to go to jail who lie and cover up and hide behind their ranks or their positions. But when push comes to shove, the real world is the real world. Mankind hasn't changed in 10,000 years, and predators are predators. And there's a lot of people out there that they're not going to ask for something, they're just going to go and take it. And unless you have hard people who are willing to stand up and be counted and to say, okay, I'll fight the fight, you better phone next time you have somebody breaking down your door or somebody's about to do harm to you or your loved ones. Don't phone me. Don't phone a lot of guys who work for these government agencies. Phone Julian Assange. You might find him. He's hiding out in the embassy. Phone, Edward Snowden. He's with his new best friends. So these are the guys that you're going to have to rely on when truly the danger hits home. Anyways, I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you very much. I don't profess to know where the balance lies, but having said all that, there's been a lot out there. I mean, everybody's making a lot of noise about this metadata and all this data coming into the possession of government. First of all, there's not enough people on the planet to go through what's in those databases, and it's no different than 20 years ago when somebody was the victim of a rape or a crime. We didn't have the technology then, but evidence or data was preserved, so in a future time, you had the technology to solve crime or to save lives. The reality is, even an email I sent 10 years ago can be useful today. If somebody was doing a reverse engineering on what my network was, and the technology that didn't exist 10 years ago exists today, that like a spider, anybody who picked up the phone and phoned you on that cell phone, I can track who you phoned there, who he phoned here. And again, it's not just governments that have this ability. Most of the private sector at the top end know the tricks of the trade. And in fact, a lot of governments, just like we saw from Snowden, hire civilian contractors. So to answer your question, governments have been collecting data for decades. It doesn't mean they're utilizing it. And I can tell you, even doing a wiretap, if we're doing a live wiretap on somebody, that takes about 6 people over a 24-hour period to run it. And you only hope that they speak English that you can understand. But when you're doing these live monitors, they speak a different language. Where are you getting the translators? The media, I think, has distorted how vast and how great the ability of government really is, because I just didn't see it all the time where I was sitting. But I think that when you used to mail letters, you know, I could tell when you sent a letter or you sent something by FedEx. I can see that who sent it and who received it, but I don't know what the content is. How is that any different than what they're collecting on metadata? They're just saying somebody from this ISP sent a message, somebody here received it. Nobody's going in there to do it. And this whole program that, and I'm only getting this from what I read in the media, that Snowden's alluding to, it's 600 people through the Five Eyes program around the world, 600 analysts who are tracking and doing all this. Okay, let's break it down logically. 600 people. So probably at any one time, half of them are off. So you got 300 people globally around the world working on this. Of that 300, probably 10%, 20% are off on maternity leave, sick leave, stress leave, so they're gone. Then now we're down to about 250 people around the world. Let's break it down. Then the other half has gone off on training, some are on vacation. So what I'm saying is we've lost context. I mean, Snowden has created a very inflammatory notion that government is out there like a big giant vacuum cleaner taking everything and then going into it. No, okay, I can see that there's been a hoovering up of data, but unless there's a specific reason to go and delve into it, and even then need warrants, they've got the courts. I'm not saying it's a perfect system, there has to be transparency, but I sure like what the Western democracies are doing to combat crime and terrorism versus what I see some other countries doing.
Peter Bozar, retired correspondent. You alluded a lot to working undercover. On a personal, practical level, when you are undercover, how do you keep your cover and make sure you don't trip yourself up?
Well, that's a good question. Typically, I went by Bill McDonald. My real name is Bill Miker, so I keep the same initials. I got in the habit of always, drunk or sober, signing the same initials, so you didn't get tripped up that way. And typically, your cover story normally is about 90% of who you really are. So it's not a big stretch. I mean, we would tell people, look at, don't say you're an engineer if you don't know what a slide rule is. And so that type of thing, we would take what people have and create the cover story for them around that. But I mean, the biggest risk sometimes is, and it happened only to me once, where I was actually with a target in a place, and I'm about 3,000 miles away, and a guy I worked with didn't know I was working, comes in, hey, Billy, what are you doing here? And then in the bathroom, the target says, Bill, how do you know that guy? And I said, I just met him earlier at another bar. That's the biggest risk at that level. But again, now with the internet, it's next to impossible to preserve yourself. So one of the things that we have to do in today's world is right now, some of you could have a child who's 15, 16 years old, say, hey, I'd like to work for the government one day, do this kind of work. Well, it's no good when he's 27 or she's 27, 30 years old to say, okay, here's your ID. So we have to start building ID now, just as I was saying, because of the databases, and go in there and create a John Smith identity in school, social security number, medical numbers, all these things that build a profile. So when 15 years later your son or daughter says, hey, I'm going to go do this work, we say, okay, here's your legend. You know, your mother and father were born or died this period of time. You have two siblings or you have no siblings. One of the things that helps in Western countries is that we do have a lot of immigration. And a lot of people from who are immigrants from other countries don't necessarily have the paperwork. So they need to have paperwork created legitimately. And that also helps in starting up relatively recent ID. But by and large, we have to start doing today, and already have started doing years ago, building covert infrastructure to give to somebody who may join government in 5 years' time.
Yes. Gentleman here and then on the right.
Thank you very much for sharing your insights with us, and especially for your candor on the topic. Sorry, David Spencer. I guess a two-part question. It seems like we all operate in our daily lives with imperfect information. But with the information I have, I very much appreciate everything that you've said, yet I also feel offended by some of the overreaching that our governments have apparently done. And so I guess my question on that part is, how do you find a happy medium such that the governments don't overreach? And if I might, the second part of the question is about the media's role in this. And, you know, so much of our world with limited information is kind of sculpted by that which we read in the papers or hear on broadcast and the like. And so there's somewhat of a filter put on that by the media. What's your take on the media's role and what type of proscriptive advice would you have for trying to strike what in your mind would be a better balance?
Both very good questions. And in fact, we were talking about that just before. I don't know what the answer is for finding that right balance. I just know that a problem told 1,000 times sounds worse than it is. I don't have the same blind faith in government that I had today from when I started my career. I saw many things that were pretty disheartening, demoralizing, and mostly because it had to do with the foibles of human nature, you know, a careerist. You know, a lot of guys in government, all they think about is the pension, having their empire. You know, the problem today is, especially in post 9/11, is empires are built on motherhood issues like security. And so in the name of security, I can ask for a big budget. I can make a business case for all sorts of things. And what's the magic answer? Well, if you don't give it to me and something does happen, you know, what's going to happen to you? So everybody does the CYA. And so empires get built. But in my experience, it's the operational guys who suffer, because the operational guys are guided typically by a purity of purpose. They actually believe in what they're doing, but they don't know how to play the political game internally. And these are the guys that need the whistleblower protection. These are the people that need to have a court system that's fairly robust about saying, okay, the government didn't do what they're supposed to do to look after you if you're being a whistleblower. Here's the punitive fine. These people are fired. But I think part of the problem is, you know, the lawyers run a lot of the business now. And even in covert ops, in policing, and military, rules of engagement, what we do, how we do it, a lot of it is guided by legal precepts and legal guidance. And so many of these lawyers also work for government, and their job is to protect the government, so they look to do risk mitigation, and it really becomes a rules-based as opposed to a principle-based decision model and how we approach a lot of these things. So to answer your question, the first question, that is, I don't have the perfect answer. And you know, what WikiLeaks purportedly stands for, I actually respect that. I don't have a problem with what it purportedly does. What I have a problem with is that so much information is just dumped out there without any context, without any consideration of the ramifications. And that, to me, is probably worse than the original event. I'm sorry, your second question was? Well, the media, I mean, a friend of mine who's an editor of a paper in Canada says, Bill, you got to remember, the media is managed by the left and owned by the right. And so you always have that, you know, that juxtaposition. But I would say, look at what happened with, you know, World of the News, you know, the hacking of phones. And there's a lot of people in the media who could turn a blind eye to that. And there's also a hue and cry. I think the problem, as we were just mentioning to Jitendra earlier, was, you know, government organizations, especially the kind that I came out of, you don't operate in the front of the cameras. So there's no ability for the media to get access to information, get access, whether it's good or bad, to what is being done on behalf of taxpayers and on society. So in the absence of accurate information, you take whatever information you can get. I can tell you, as an aside with the media definitely has a role. I'm absolute 100% behind responsible journalism. I don't have a lot of use for yellow journalism. You know, I love these stories that are supposed to be reporting the news, but what I end up reading in a news story is an editorial comment. So I whether I agree with the issue or not, I think the transparency of media has been distorted. Again, it's the drive for profits. I get it. I understand it. But I need responsible government. You need responsible journalists. I suppose it's the easy answer.
I know we've got a couple of hands up, but I think we've got about 2 minutes left. I'm going to try and squeeze one more question in, perhaps, to if we have time. So first on the
round. Bill, name is Henry Arslanian. First of all, as a fellow Canadian from Montreal, I just want to thank you for your candor and also for your talk and for your service to the country. Based on what you mentioned, this post, WikiLeaks, and Snowden area, I just wanted to know, in your personal experience, what's the biggest threat you think we face currently? Is it in this post-Crimea world, Russia? Is it Chinese espionage? Is it the Al-Qaeda? Is it some of the groups you were looking at beforehand? And that's my first question. Second quick question is, on a personal basis, aren't you worried about your own security? Yeah, with the bounty that was on your head and speaking on events like this? Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, no, thank you. To answer your first question, as a Canadian, I'd say the greatest threat to our security is the Canadian Bar Association. But a lawyer, even better. I think the greatest threat really is public is apathy by those involved in the battle. Because organized crime and terrorism, it all interlinks. Most probably 90% of terrorist financing comes from drug or fraudulent activities, and so the two are very inextricably linked. And so what do I see as the danger? I see the danger is the financial facilitators. And when I did that last project out of Miami, that was the one lesson we really saw. We're doing multiple operations, but I had guys tied into the Italian mafia, tied into the Hells Angels, tied into Russian mafia, tied into essentially Colombian, and I was dealing with the same banker for all of it. So that was the thing that was a real revelation to us, is how much that offshore banking system has been compromised by almost the entire cadre of transnational crime and, to a lesser degree, the terrorist groups. And the second question was?
Personal security.
I'll tell you a little bit my background there. I'm the only one guy that I'm a bit worried about. He's still in custody right now. We had him linked to 12 murders. And he'll be getting out of prison in about 3 years. I had to go into hiding at the end of that project because he had reached out, we believe he reached out to a hitman to either get me or one other witness, but I was the only guy testifying against him. So he was reaching out to a contract killer that we became aware of. And so the government says, hey, look, Bill, why don't you go lie low until you testify? So they gave me a choice. I could stay in North America and have a gun, or I could go somewhere else but couldn't take a firearm with me. So I chose to go to Marseille for 5 months. So Canadian taxpayer did me a favor, and I studied at Alliance Française to get some French, and I laid low till I came to testify. But I today get several checks from the government. One is my pension, 23-year pension for being a federal employee. I've been almost murdered on two occasions, so I get a disability check for injuries. I got a cervical disc disease from getting blows across the neck. And I receive another separate pension for, not very big, mind you, for blows across the head again, where I got some nerve damage, where I got severed nerves across the back of my head from a steel bar. And then the last one is not so sexy, but like a lot of guys spend time on firing ranges, I have tinnitus. So I got a small 5% pension for hearing loss. But do I worry about it? I've had it said to me, I hope you don't have any kids. I said, well, what do you mean by that? Well, you know what I mean by that. So there was a time when we could deal with that a little more forcefully when you got those kind of threats. But today, everybody's about the victim, or I'm sorry, everybody's about the accused, not the victim. But there's only one guy that I actually worry about.
I'm going to squeeze in one final question, then we'll wrap it up.
Martin. Hi, I'm Martin Mertz, associate member. Towards the end of your speech, you said something very tantalizing, that you had witnessed a lot of bad doings by the government. Could you, perhaps in the short time that's left, tell us the most egregious government crime, that you witnessed and what you did about it, as perhaps a hint to what future Snowdens could do.
I don't know if we have enough time. I'll tell you one example, and so I can appreciate some of them. I don't want to get into because it would lead to a lot of litigation. But I was working in a unit, and we had the audit team coming around, and the audit team was coming to do an operational audit of the files, and to do an administrative audit for finances and the like. And so a week before that audit, and I was the only what we call an HQ number, meaning I had a headquarters number, meaning I was a trained undercover officer. I was the only one in the unit at the time. And so we have within these operational units, we have a thing called RO580 money, which is secret money. So it doesn't go through the normal expense through open source within the system. You have expense money for paying informants or for doing operations. So I was aware that my bosses in that unit were using RO580 money for personal benefit, for suits, rental cars. Hey, Bill, you got the COVID ID, go rent a nice Mercedes so we could drive. And they give themselves temporary, what's called a DR number, temporary numbers. So it gives them the cachet of doing undercover. And so the week before that occurred, the unit head called me in. He said, look, Bill, next week the audit team's coming in. And when they ask you how everything is, you're to tell them everything is fine, sir. I said, okay. So next week the audit team came in. I get called in to be interviewed. And they said, Bill, before we begin, is there anything you want to tell us? I said, yeah, I was told to tell you that everything's fine, sir. And they said, well, what do you mean by that? And then I explained it to them. What do you think happened about 2 weeks later? I had an internal investigation by the one guy on a totally unrelated matter that was nonsense. But all of a sudden, I'm under an internal. I had my desk searched, my laptops taken, everything taken, and it was all for bogus. So do I sympathize with the whistleblowers? Absolutely. Do I know that there are bullies with badges? Absolutely. Do I see that people who hide behind rank to cover their incompetency? Yeah, I've seen it all my whole career. But I also saw a lot of very good people, a lot of very motivated people, a lot of people who spilled real blood, took real risks, sacrificed their own families and their marriages to try to do the right thing. So we shouldn't forget those guys in the whole answer.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's been enlightening.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
On behalf of the FCC, I'd like to present you with a little token of our appreciation. And you're always welcome to come back again, Bill.
I appreciate it. Thank you, Wayne. Thank you.
Thank you.